It had a Lord Mayor who was elected yearly. And we've already met one of these, William Walworth, the one who stabbed Wat Tyler during the Peasants' Revolt. But the most famous Lord Mayor of London during the Middle Ages was Sir Richard Whittington, or Dick Whittington. He was the younger son of a gentleman from Staffordshire. He came to London in the late 14th century to make his fortune in the cloth trade, which he did. And he became rich enough to lend money to kings, and he was elected Lord Mayor 3 times, which was an unprecedented achievement, and he also served in Parliament. Now, the reason he's remembered, though, is that somehow he became a character in the English pantomime tradition. These are the comic plays that are still part of the tradition of English childhood. Starting in the early 17th century, there are stories about Dick Whittington in which he is a poor boy who comes to London to make good. At first, he gets nowhere. And he finally turns to leave London discouraged. Then he hears the sound of Bow Bells, the famous church bells of St. Mary Le Bow, calling him back to London to try again. And in many of the stories, he gets rich with the aid of his cat. He takes this fabulous cat on a trading voyage, and the cat's rat-catching abilities win him many friends. In some versions, the cat can talk. Now, the story is obviously meant to be a rags-to-riches story. But for us, I think the lesson is that the profile of the real Sir Richard Whittington was far more typical. He starts out with some means, and he gets even richer. And the sort of success that he achieved is definitely possible in London in the 15th century. Now, Lord Mayor of London is really a ceremonial post. London is dominated by the great merchant guilds, especially those involved with the cloth trade. London merchants often made such large fortunes that the crown turned to them for loans. Edward IV helped cement his relationships with some of these merchants by conferring knighthood on them. A little social prestige in exchange for a little cash. This is obviously not the way knighthood starts out. Knights are supposed to be warriors. But things had been changing for some time. Everyone had come to recognize the vital importance of money and trade. Now, still, social prejudices remained, and often successful London merchants would try to buy landed estates as soon as they could and retire to the countryside. But still, London is a force to be reckoned with, and it's going to play a decisive role in the very dramatic events that followed the death of Edward IV in 1483. And that's what we'll take up next time.
Lecture 35, Richard III, Betrayal and Defeat.
Welcome back. In our last lecture, we covered most of the period known as the Wars of the Roses, and we saw the momentum shift back and forth between Yorkists and Lancastrians. First, the Yorkists gain the throne, then they lose it temporarily, then they're back. And we ended with the death of Edward IV in 1483. And it looked at that point as if the new Yorkist dynasty was secure. Now, Edward had left a fairly secure financial situation for the crown. He'd also dealt with the last of the really disruptive elements among the barons. So everything seemed good. But I warned you last time, there's going to be one more act in the Wars of the Roses. And that's going to be the subject of our lecture today. We're going to spend the whole lecture talking about a period of a little more than 2 years. But they were two of the most eventful years in our whole period. We're going to see one king murdered, almost certainly. Another will die in battle. And that battle will mark the end point of our course, because then a new dynasty takes over, the Tudors. And that really belongs to the early modern period, or the Renaissance, not the Middle Ages. So we're going to watch the last act unfold today. Now, we start in the spring of 1483 with the death of Edward IV. His realm is prosperous, but unfortunately, he leaves a child as his heir, his oldest son Edward, aged 12, and he now becomes Edward V. But the court is split. It's split between two powerful factions, and we've seen this dynamic before, especially during the minority of Henry VI. So we've got two factions. The first of these factions is led by Richard, Duke of Gloucester, the only surviving brother of Edward IV. The other faction is led by Elizabeth Woodville, the queen, and she has a numerous family. A lot of these relatives have gotten patronage under Edward IV, they've prospered, and they're deeply unpopular as a result. Richard of Gloucester, though, is quite popular. He's been very loyal to his brother, the king. He never got involved in the sorts of plots that tripped up his brother, the Duke of Clarence. Richard had also been very successful serving as the king's lieutenant in the north. So Richard is, in many ways, ideally placed to help his young nephew, to train him in statecraft. And in fact, Richard is named Lord Protector in the king's will. But the queen's faction wants to get hold of the new king. They want to secure the person of young Edward. They want a regency council because they're going to hope to dominate that. So the queen's brother, Earl Rivers, temporarily has custody of the king at the time Edward IV dies, and he wants to bring him to London to meet up with the rest of the Woodville faction. But Richard, Duke of Gloucester, has other plans. He and his ally, the Duke of Buckingham, intercept Earl Rivers on the way to London. They have a stronger band of followers, and they seize control of the king. They bring him to London themselves, and they have Earl Rivers executed. And really, there's not even any legal pretext for this. This, of course, makes the queen panic. She flees into sanctuary in Westminster Abbey with her other children, just as she had done many years earlier when her husband, Edward IV, was temporarily driven from the throne. So here's Richard, Duke of Gloucester. He has essentially staged a successful coup against his rivals, and he now has sole control of the new king. Now, when exactly Richard decided that he was going to take the next step, he was going to seize the throne for himself, we don't know for sure. Maybe he always had it in mind, but at any rate, within 2 months of his nephew's accession, Richard claimed the throne. He probably acted partly out of self-preservation. He knew his nephew was going to grow up. And then there would be a decline in his influence, obviously, and Richard probably feared that the Woodville faction would act against him. And given how ruthless politics had become in this period, I think that was probably a reasonable fear. So Richard may have felt that if he was going to stay alive, he himself had to be king. But how was he going to get rid of his nephew? Now, it's actually pretty interesting how he did this, and it says a lot about how English politics have changed in the last couple of centuries. The first thing to say is that he goes through Parliament. By this point, it's well established that if you want to depose a king, you need to get Parliament to approve of this. This had already happened several times. We've seen Edward II, we've seen Richard II, we've seen Henry VI, all deposed by Parliament. Edward IV was temporarily deposed by Parliament. So Richard knows that if he wants to take over, he needs Parliament to help him do it. That's how important the institution has become by now. The second thing is that Richard needs a pretext. He needs to give Parliament something to go on. So far, we've seen two depositions that came about basically due to the fact that the king was incompetent. He had just alienated too many of his supporters. That had happened with Edward II and with Richard II. But nobody at the time had claimed that they weren't legitimate kings in a genealogical sense. They clearly were. But then you had Henry VI. He was deposed for a mixture of two reasons. First, he was incompetent, but second, his right to the throne was questionable. He came from the Lancastrian line. They are the ones who had inserted themselves into the royal succession illegitimately at the time of Richard II's deposition. Now, I don't think the issue of the legitimacy of the dynasty would have come up if Henry had been a successful king. People would have left it alone. But he wasn't a successful king, and that opened the door. So there are these two grounds that have been used to challenge the right of a king to rule: incompetence and legitimacy. Now, if Richard, Duke of Gloucester, wants to challenge the right of his nephew to rule, what's going to be his pretext? Now, he can't really challenge Edward V's competence. Edward is 12. He hasn't done anything yet. And Richard is the protector. So that's not an option. The only option left is to question Edward's right to the throne. But wait. At the time of the struggle between York and Lancaster, you have two different branches of the English royal family, each competing against each other. They trace their descent from different sons of Edward III. Now, you can have an argument about whether it's legitimate to trace descent through the female line. That's what the Yorkists have to do. But you've got essentially two rationales for two different branches of the royal family. But what's Richard going to argue? He and his nephew come from the same branch of the royal family. If he's going to challenge Edward V's claim to the throne, he's going to have to be very careful. He's going to have to come up with a rationale that disallows his nephew's claim to the throne, but leaves his own claim intact. So he decides to claim that Edward is a bastard. He claims that the marriage between Edward IV and Elizabeth Woodville was invalid. And obviously, that would make their children illegitimate. Now, the pretext for claiming this is that Edward IV had supposedly been under contract of marriage even before he married Elizabeth Woodville, supposedly to a woman named Lady Eleanor Butler. Now, under canon law, this would indeed make Edward's marriage to Elizabeth Woodville invalid. Now, the trouble is, there seems to be no evidence of this story at all. It was purely invented. Now, Richard does produce a bishop who swears that he performed a wedding between Edward and Lady Eleanor, but almost certainly the bishop was lying. Now, Richard has his close ally, Buckingham, recount this story of this supposed marriage to the mayor and the citizens of London. And then he has the story repeated from all the pulpits of the city. It's a very well-orchestrated propaganda campaign. It shows that Richard thinks the public opinion of the Londoners is worth cultivating. Now, certainly, London public opinion has an impact on Parliament. We've seen that before. What the crowds in London are thinking, that influences Parliament. And Parliament meets on June 25th. And officially, they petition Richard to take the crown on the grounds that Buckingham had outlined about the marriage of Edward IV being invalid. So this brings me to my third point about how politics has developed. You can sway Parliament. You can use propaganda. You can exert public pressure. England has made a lot of progress, but we're not at the point where the rich and powerful can't bend the will of the people for their own purposes. But, and this is a very large but, the will of the people has a way of making itself felt in any case, because this usurpation of the throne proved to be deeply unpopular. When people had time to think about it, they didn't believe this story about Edward's marriage. They saw the whole thing for what it was, a pretty naked power grab. And we'll see that discontent dogged Richard throughout his reign. And in the end, he suffered the fate of unpopular kings. People didn't want to fight to keep him on the throne. And that was the ultimate verdict on Richard's reign. But for the moment, Richard had coerced the people he needed to coerce. And thus, on July 6th, Richard was crowned King of England. And the former king, now once again Edward, Prince of Wales, is confined to the Tower along with his younger brother, Richard, Duke of York. Now, supposedly, these two princes are in the Tower for safekeeping. Really, they're in jail. But by the fall of 1483, they had disappeared. And no one saw them alive again. And how we've finally come to the greatest medieval mystery of all. What happened to the princes in the Tower? Now, nobody knows for sure, but in 1674, two skeletons were found at the Tower, and they seemed to be of about the right ages for the two princes. So maybe those are the princes. But we can't tell from the skeletons how the children died. I'm going to lay my cards right out on the table. I think Richard had them murdered. I don't think there's really any good reason to believe otherwise. There's been a lot of attempts, very ingenious attempts to deflect blame away from Richard. In fact, there's a whole society called the Richard III Society that's devoted to trying to rescue his reputation. Other suspects have been put forward, the Duke of Buckingham, for instance, or Henry Tudor, the man who's ultimately going to defeat Richard and replace him on the throne. But I don't think any of these possible theories holds any water. Richard had means, motive, and opportunity, and I don't think any of the other possible suspects had all three. So I do think Richard is responsible for killing the princess. But that doesn't mean everything we've been told about Richard is true. Probably a lot of people first encounter Richard III through Shakespeare's play of the same name. Now, it's a wonderful play, but just as with a lot of other things in Shakespeare, we've already seen this, it's not purely historical. Now, here Shakespeare is merely adapting the sources he had, and these are historical accounts written after Richard's death by his political enemies. And these writers have a stake in making Richard look as bad as possible, because they want to justify the fact that he was defeated and removed from the throne. So that's why you get this picture of Richard as this personification of evil. And certainly the second most famous thing about Richard, after the fact that he supposedly killed the princes, is the fact that he's supposedly a hunchback. And you'll often see him portrayed on stage this way. That's how he is in Shakespeare's play. There's no contemporary evidence for this. It's just possible that he may have had one shoulder a little higher than the other, but even that is uncertain. But the story about him being a hunchback is really later propaganda. This is a very crude way in which later writers are trying to make this physical deformity stand for a moral deformity. What is true is the fact that he was probably short and maybe slight of build. And that's something in itself that hurts a king's image. He doesn't look like a king the way some of the others did, like his own brother, Edward IV. But the real blows to Richard's image are dealt by his own actions, first by the usurpation, and then by the rumors, almost certainly true, that he had killed the princes. And I don't think anybody needed to invent that. Now, if you want to say anything at all to get him off the hook, it would have to be that in killing the princes, Richard isn't really stepping very far outside the norms of English politics as they've developed in recent decades. It had been a pretty rough time lately. King Edward IV had had his own brother, Richard's brother too, the Duke of Clarence, murdered. Now, it's a bit different to kill children. But I think that Richard felt driven to get rid of the princes just the way all of the previous usurping monarchs in the past two centuries had gotten rid of their predecessors. I think that was the precedent Richard was following. You can't allow an ex-king to live. It's just too dangerous. They're going to be a focus for potential rebellion. But getting rid of the princes did not guarantee Richard a smooth ride. He had taken the throne under unusual circumstances, to say the least, and this had cost him a lot of political capital. All of that earlier popularity is really gone. The people are disillusioned, and so are many of the barons. I don't think they swallow the story about the marriage. They see his rule as illegitimate from the start. Now, remember the benevolences from Edward IV's reign? These are those supposedly free payments that people make to the king. Really, they're extorted. Under Richard's reign, people rename these the malevolences, because they are extracted with such ill will. You can't even put a fig leaf on this anymore. And people also don't like or trust Richard's close advisors. He had three of these: William Catesby, Sir Richard Ratcliffe, and Lord Lovell. Catesby, Ratcliffe, and Lovell. And there's a very famous rhyme about these henchmen of Richard's that went around, and this is how it goes. The cat, the rat, and Lovell, our dog, all rule England Under the Hog. Now, the cat was Catesby, the rat was Ratcliffe, and Lovell, our dog, was, of course, Lord Lovell. Now, the hog was Richard himself. His emblem was the white boar. So the idea is that these advisors are essentially ruling under the king, and nobody likes these overpowerful royal advisors. Now, the author of this little rhyme, a gentleman from Wiltshire, was named Thomas Collingbourne, and he was hanged for writing it. And I think that's a sign of how insecure Richard felt on the throne. And he had very good reason to feel insecure. In the fall of 1483, the gentry of southern England rose in revolt in protest at Richard's treatment of his nephews. Now, some of these rebels were former servants of Edward IV. They were angry that their patron's honor had been impugned. They didn't like that Edward's sons were being declared bastards. Now, Queen Elizabeth Woodville was also in on this. She entered into secret negotiations with Henry Tudor, the surviving Lancastrian claimant to the throne, and I'll explain why he's a claimant to the throne in a moment. Elizabeth promised to support Henry Tudor's claim to the throne if he would marry her oldest daughter, Elizabeth of York, and thus make her Queen of England. Now, I think this is pretty good evidence that by this point, in the fall of 1483, Elizabeth Woodville has concluded that her sons in the Tower have been killed, and so she's willing to transfer their claim to the throne to their sister. And Henry Tudor did swear publicly in exile in France. He swore publicly to marry Elizabeth of York. So we have this revolt involving the mother of the deposed Yorkist king and the current Lancastrian claimant to the throne. So that's already hard enough to grasp. But then something odd happens, and we don't really understand it to this day. The Duke of Buckingham, the man who had stood by Richard through all of those tumultuous weeks in the spring and the early summer, the guy who had stage-managed the process of claiming the throne, Buckingham joined in the revolt. Now, some later fictional accounts suggest that Buckingham may have revolted because he got wind of the fact that Richard had had the princes murdered. But we don't really have any solid evidence to back that up. We don't know why he changed sides. But the revolt failed, and it was the usual story. You have different allies trying unsuccessfully to gather their forces in, and they're picked off one by one. Buckingham was captured in Shropshire while trying to bring troops from Wales to meet up with rebels who were closer to London, and Buckingham was executed after a summary trial. Henry Tudor was on his way from Brittany. He appeared off the coast of Dorset in the southwest, but he never landed. He had arrived too late, and he just went home. But Henry Tudor persevered. Now I have to tell you who he is. Why is he even under discussion as a potential claimant to the English throne? It turns out he is the last best Lancastrian hope. He has a claim on both sides of the family, though either way the claim is a little tenuous. His mother was Margaret Beaufort. She's a member of the very powerful Beaufort family. Remember, they're the offspring of Edward III's son, John of Gaunt, and his mistress, Catherine Swynford. And these children had been legitimized after the fact. But later on, Henry IV had procured a measure that barred the Beauforts from the succession to the throne. So that's something of a problem right there. That's probably Henry Tudor's strongest claim to the throne. He is a descendant of Edward III, but through an originally illegitimate line that has been officially debarred from the succession by Act of Parliament. So that's not a terribly strong claim. Now, the claim that Henry Tudor has on his father's side is more of association than of actual descent. Henry Tudor's father, Edmund Tudor, was the son of the widow of Henry V, Queen Catherine, the one from France that Henry V had married. Now, after Henry V died, Catherine had married a second time. If there ever was a legal marriage, there's some doubt about this. The man in question was Owen Tudor, a Welsh page in the royal household. So it seems as if Queen Catherine contracted an alliance for love in this case. Surely she had no idea that she was also going to help to found a new English dynasty. So here's Henry the Tudor's claim to the throne. It's not very impressive in itself. And furthermore, due to the fact that the Lancastrians have been out of power since 1471, Henry Tudor has spent most of his life thus far in exile in France. He has very few English connections. He has more Welsh relatives than English relatives. But Henry comes from very stern stock. The Beauforts, his mother's family, they're a very formidable lot, and Henry seems to have inherited their grit. And there's nobody else. Henry Tudor is the last Lancastrian claimant. And once again, we see continental politics involved in the struggle for the English throne. Henry Tudor had launched his first attempt on England in 1483 from Brittany, and he had fled back to Brittany when the revolt unraveled. Now, King Richard then tried to have the Bretons send Henry back to England to stand trial. He wanted him extradited, essentially. Now, Brittany is a semi-autonomous duchy at this point. But Henry escaped. He went to the French court. And Richard is threatening to send troops to Brittany. Now, the French don't want this, and they decide that in order to block this invasion, they're going to back Henry's claim to the throne. They provide him with money, a small force of soldiers, possibly some Scottish soldiers. Remember, the French and the Scots are allies. Now, thus, we have in August of 1485, Henry Tudor lands at Milford Haven in Wales, and he tries to seize the throne. Now, he's done all he can in advance to prepare for the landing. He has canvassed potential supporters. He has particularly concentrated on the Stanley family. Now, the Stanleys were Yorkists, but Lord Stanley was the third husband of Henry's mother, Margaret Beaufort. So Lord Stanley is Henry's stepfather. So Henry has a potential in with the Stanleys. So Henry sets out from Milford Haven with the intention of joining up with his supporters along the way. Now, the whole process is nerve-wracking. This is always the dangerous part of a rebellion when you're trying to get your forces together. And the fact that Henry Tudor has landed is swiftly known in London. And clearly, of course, the king is going to respond. He moves against the Stanleys. Lord Stanley's son is seized and held as a hostage for his father's good behavior. So Stanley could not, in fact, promise to come to Henry Tudor's aid. Nevertheless, Henry presses on towards Leicester. He wants a quick decision, because the longer he waits to bring the king to battle, the greater the risk that his forces, that he's very painstakingly gathered together, will disperse again. Now, Richard probably wanted a battle too. Richard probably felt that as long as Henry Tudor is out there, his throne is not secure. He certainly knew that he hadn't managed to win over his subjects, because when the invasion came, he had to send out writs ordering men to come out and fight for him, on the threat of losing their goods, estates, and lives. Now, the realm is being invaded. It's not a good sign if people have to be threatened into coming out to repel an invader. It's also clear Richard felt he couldn't trust his own men. He's reported to have told Sir Robert Brackenbury, one of his followers, to keep an eye on certain questionable gentry as the army moves towards Leicester. And he also got word from the north that his supposedly trusted lieutenant, the Earl of Northumberland, hasn't been doing much of anything to raise troops on his behalf. So the signs were looking bad. Nevertheless, Richard pressed on because he wanted to intercept Henry before he could reach London. So on August 22nd, 1485, the two armies met at Bosworth Field in Leicestershire. The Yorkist army numbered maybe 10,000, and they deployed on a hilltop, which is usually a very strong position. Richard commanded the center of the army, while the Duke of Norfolk had the left flank and the Earl of Northumberland had the right. Norfolk was guarding a group of cannons, and they also have a sizable contingent of archers. The Stanleys are held in reserve. They're holding a nearby hill. Now, Henry Tudor's army is about half the size of the Royal Army, maybe 5,000 men. They're positioned to the southwest of the hill where the Yorkists are deployed. And the big question now is, what are the Stanleys going to do? Stanley is Henry Tudor's stepfather, but his oldest son is a captive of King Richard. He's actually with Richard, and Richard sends Stanley a message threatening to execute his son if Stanley does not advance. Stanley replies, he has other sons. Now, in fury, Richard orders the captive to be executed, but his men waffle. They say it'd be better to wait till after the battle. Clearly, they're nervous about how it's all going to turn out. They want to hedge their bets. Now, Stanley also got a message from Henry Tudor asking for his help, and Stanley replied, he's going to come, of course, after it's clear what Henry's battle arrangements are going to be. What this really means is Stanley is not coming right away. He, too, is going to wait and see. And so battle is joined. The Lancastrian army is led by the Earl of Oxford, who is an experienced commander. Henry Tudor knows he's not an experienced soldier. He feels he's more valuable in the rear. Oxford groups his soldiers tightly together to maneuver them successfully around a marsh that lay between them and the enemy. And then they advance. They're harassed all the time by the Yorkists' cannon. But the two armies close with each other, and you have hand-to-hand fighting. At this point, King Richard ordered Northumberland to advance, but his force did not move. Now, no one's sure whether this refusal to support Richard was planned in advance, but it certainly hurt the Yorkist cause substantially. Now, at this point, Henry Tudor rode over to try to confer with Stanley, who's still holding aloof. I think he went to say, come on, come on, get into the battle. Richard spotted Henry's movement, and he decided to try to end the battle quickly by killing the opposing commander. So Richard led a charge of about 800 mounted soldiers right at Henry Tudor's contingent. And he got very close to Henry himself. He even killed Henry's standard bearer personally before Henry's bodyguard managed to close around him. And there was fierce hand-to-hand fighting. It was at this point that Stanley finally made a move. He joined in decisively on the Lancastrian side. His troops overwhelmed the Yorkist contingent that was trying to get to Henry Tudor. Richard's own standard bearer was cut down, and the king's horse got his hooves stuck in the mud, so Richard had to continue to fight on foot. Now, Shakespeare has Richard call out, "A horse, a horse, my kingdom for a horse!" But contemporary accounts suggest that Richard's followers offered their own horses so the king could escape, but he refused. He fought bravely to the end. I think he knew there wasn't a lot of point in him surviving the battle if he lost. His fate was likely to be a very unhappy one. And that was the end of the Yorkists and the beginning of the new Tudor dynasty. Well, it's an exciting story. The Wars of the Roses are full of epic battles and colorful characters. But what did it mean? What does it matter? I think there's a mixed legacy from these wars. One thing you can certainly say is that politics had gotten a lot more savage. There are a lot more executions for basically political purposes in this period than we saw in earlier times. It was very risky to be at the center of political life in England because it's so often polarized into two factions, and those factions by the end of this period are not scrupling to execute each other's supporters on very flimsy grounds or no grounds at all. In another sense, though, the very savagery of politics shows us how high the stakes are seen to be. I think possession of the crown became so contentious because it had become so important. The power of the crown, in one sense, had been increasingly restricted over the course of the last two centuries. Now you have parliament to contend with. You have to ask for taxes. But it's also true that there are more taxes to ask for than ever before. The economy had expanded. England is much richer than it had been at the time of the Norman conquest. There's more wealth to compete for. But all that wealth has to be administered by a competent king. If you don't have someone at the center who knows what they're doing, who can balance competing interests against each other, placate the commons, conduct a competent foreign policy, then the whole kingdom is going to lose. It matters who is king. A good king can help the whole kingdom. A bad king can bring the whole kingdom down. England can't afford a bad king. And if they get a bad king, someone among the various powerful barons with some ghost of a claim to the throne, is going to be found to get rid of him. But there's another fundamental truth about the Wars of the Roses, and that's something we talked about a few lectures ago when we talked about daily life. The 15th century may have been a very risky time to be at the center of politics, but it's a basically good time to be anybody else. The economy is largely flourishing. It's bounced back from the Black Death. And most people are largely unaffected by the Wars of the Roses. There are some areas of the country that never saw any fighting at all. And if you add up all of the battle casualties, they probably number in the tens of thousands, certainly not the hundreds of thousands. This is not the sort of struggle that affects every single English village. Far from it. So when Henry Tudor wins his victory at Bosworth, he's inheriting a kingdom that's basically in good shape. There's certainly going to have to be some political realignment. Henry does get rid of a lot of Yorkists, but he makes an effort to reconcile them to his cause. He carries out his promise to marry Elizabeth of York. And this is very important because his own claim to the throne is pretty shaky. Elizabeth's is a lot better. But if you combine her pedigree with his right of conquest, you have a combination that English people are willing to support. So the Battle of Bosworth Field does mark the end of a long period of instability at the center of English politics, and thus it's a good place to end our survey of medieval England. In our next lecture, we're going to look back at what we've covered in this course, and we'll draw some general lessons.
Lecture 36, England in 1485.
Welcome back for the final time. In our last lecture, we looked at the brief and disastrous reign of Richard III, and we saw him lose his throne to Henry Tudor, the Lancastrian claimant to the throne. But Henry was really the founder of a new dynasty, and with the Tudors, we finally leave the Middle Ages, and hence our course. So in this lecture, I want to take some time to reflect on what we've been doing up to now. We'll look briefly at the changeover to Tudor rule, but then we're going to sum up a few of the most important themes of the course. We'll talk about kingship and how it developed over the period that we've covered. We'll look at the rise of Parliament and the political nation in England. We'll revisit the question of what England was, what made it a coherent entity. And finally, we'll end with the English people themselves. What had been their journey over these 1,000 years of history? How is their future going to be shaped by the developments we've been examining? First, though, I want to say a bit more about the transition from Yorkist rule to Tudor rule in 1485 and the years immediately following. The first thing is to say is that we know 1485 was going to turn out to be a major dividing line in English history. But of course, people at the time didn't know this. They didn't know that dynastic instability was basically over for the time being. Things had been very unsettled at the top in England for many years now, really since the reign of Richard II. And for all anybody knew, it was going to continue that way. But it didn't. And one big reason why is that Henry VII, Henry Tudor, was a successful king. He was able to meet the challenges that England faced in the late 15th century, and he paved the way for a pretty long period of relative stability and peace in English history. He restored the royal finances to good health, largely by being very tight-fisted. He was determined not to live beyond his means, so that removed one constant source of friction between the king and his people, all of those disputes over lavish spending and high taxes. But that was the positive side of Henry's achievement. The negative side is that Henry clearly looked back at the last few decades of English politics and concluded that the problem was the existence of too many people with a plausible claim to the English throne. Remember, that was the issue with Richard, Duke of York, back in Henry VI's reign. Richard of York had a claim. The question was, would he use it? Henry Tudor does not want any of those ticking genealogical time bombs out there. He wants to eliminate potential rivals proactively before they get it in their heads to remind people of their royal descent and maybe start gathering support for a revolt. Now, he doesn't come to this conclusion just by looking to the rather distant past, all the way back to the 1450s. He has to face a couple of challenges to his rule from people who are claiming to be legitimate Yorkist heirs to the throne. Now, the first of these challenges arises very early in Henry's reign. A 10-year-old boy named Lambert Simnel, a Londoner of very humble birth, catches the eye of a priest named Roger Simon. Simon thinks this boy bears a very striking resemblance to the Yorkist family. So Simon takes young Simnel under his wing, teaches him courtly manners, and passes him off as the Earl of Warwick, who would have been the young son of George, Duke of Clarence, King Richard's brother. The young Earl had been kept in the Tower of London ever since King Henry came to the throne because his claim to the throne was seen as a threat. Now, Simon took young Simnel, the supposed Earl of Warwick, to Ireland, where there had always been a lot of support for the Yorkists. Remember, that's where Richard, Duke of York, had spent time gathering his forces before he made his claim to the throne. And the Irish administration welcomed young Simnel with open arms, and he was actually crowned king in Dublin. Other Yorkists began coming out of the woodwork, and Simnel also got considerable help from Margaret of Burgundy, who was the sister of Edward IV and Richard III. So, Simnel is the figurehead, and a Yorkist army lands in Lancashire in June of 1487. And on June 16th, they go up against the royal army at Stoke Field in Nottinghamshire, but they're defeated. And Roger Simon is captured and imprisoned for life. He's a cleric, so he isn't executed. But King Henry is merciful to poor Lambert Simnel. Clearly, he had been taken advantage of. He was too young to be responsible for any of the planning of the rebellion. But the king wanted to make it very clear that he did not believe the claim that Simnel was the Earl of Warwick. So he gave Simnel a job as a spit turner in the palace kitchens. That's the guy who stands there turning the joint of meat as it roasts on a spit. And that's obviously a pretty humble occupation. Later, though, Simnel became a falconer, which is a fairly skilled profession, and he lived until 1525, well into the reign of Henry's son, Henry VIII. But Henry VII was not going to be merciful a second time. Another Yorkist pretender arose a few years later. Pretender is just the technical term for anybody advancing a claim to a title. So this second pretender is claiming to be Richard, Duke of York, the younger of the two princes in the Tower. The story was that he had escaped from the Tower and made his way to the continent. Now, in reality, this guy named Perkin Warbeck is probably just an apprentice from Flanders, and he bears a striking resemblance, again, to the Yorkist family. So Warbeck gathers support on the continent, and in 1497, he lands in Cornwall. But a royal force comes to meet him, Warbeck panics, he deserts his army, and he's captured, and he's imprisoned in the Tower. 2 years later, he is executed. Now, over the next several decades, Henry VII and his son, Henry VIII, systematically get rid of any genuine Yorkist claimants they can get their hands on. And this extends to the female members of the family. For example, Margaret de la Pole is the sister of the Earl of Warwick. She is executed by Henry VIII in 1541 at the age of 68. The Tudors are taking no chances that there's going to be any sort of Yorkist revival. But as I said, we know the Tudors are going to succeed. We know that they are now securely on the throne. So for us, it's time to look back. And we'll do what we've done a few times before. We'll look at all of the main political actors in English society. We'll start at the top, and we'll work our way down. So let's start with kings. We have talked about a lot of individual kings in this course, but now I want to talk about them as a whole. What made them succeed? What made them fail? Now, the most important thing that determined a king's success or failure throughout the period covered in our course was the ability of the king to keep the allegiance of the great barons. The kings in this period are never rich and powerful enough to rule without the support of their barons. They have to have their military support. There isn't a large standing army that the king can command independently. Now, of course, the kings could and did hire mercenaries more and more as the Middle Ages progressed, but for that they needed money, and they could get that most easily from the barons and later from Parliament. So the kings need their barons. But what made the barons likely to support a particular king? There are certain qualities that seem to make for a good king, a popular king, a king people would fight for and pay taxes to. It helps if kings seem king-like. Being tall and handsome seemed to help. Increasingly, it helped to be seen as chivalrous. Think of Edward III founding the Order of the Garter, supposedly to save a woman from embarrassment. That's one way in which kingship changes, along with social mores. But kings also have to command a certain degree of personal respect. It helps if the king is somebody you're just a little bit in awe of. Think of Edward I being so intimidating that he didn't even have to come home to England from crusade for 2 years. No one is going to put a foot wrong while he's away because they're afraid of what he's going to do when he gets back. Now, by contrast, kings who don't live up to this expectation of what kings are supposed to be like often got into trouble. Kings are not supposed to engage in behavior that seemed to violate taboos. For example, nobody blinks an eye if the king has mistresses. But they object very strongly when King John engages in rather predatory sexual behavior. You're not supposed to go after your own barons' wives and daughters. The English barons also don't like Edward II's unkingly hobbies. The English like their kings to do certain things that seem royal, like hunting and hawking. They don't want them out there working in the yard. There's an image of how a king should behave, and it helps a lot if a king can conform to that image. But of course, it's also important to back up that general kingly impression with actual deeds when necessary. A certain degree of ruthlessness makes a big impression. It convinces people that the king is willing to do whatever he has to do. Think of Henry I and the dreadful punishment he handed out to his moneyers. Think of Edward III seeming absolutely ready to hang the burghers of Calais. Now, whether or not he really planned to pardon them all along, everybody at the time clearly believed that he might just go ahead with executing them. Poor King Stephen, on the other hand, is always being generous and chivalrous at just the wrong times. He spares Empress Matilda when she first lands in England, and this paves the way for civil war. He refuses to kill his hostage, little William Marshall. Now, we might admire him for that, but his contemporaries thought he was a bit soft. So you had to look like a king, you had to act like a king, be a little intimidating. But barons aren't just going to follow the king because they're afraid of him. There has to be something in it for them as well, something positive. Kings needed to reward faithful service, to create a climate of hopeful expectation among their followers. They need to give out those escutes and wardships to the right people at the right time. They have to be very careful about their use of patronage. Now, of course, the most spectacular patron in English history was William the Conqueror. He has essentially a whole kingdom to hand out. But even then, he has some trouble with his followers because, inevitably, some people are dissatisfied with what they have. And so he has to put down several rebellions by disgruntled barons. But mostly, we hear about patronage when kings are seen to be abusing it, rewarding the wrong people. This was a huge issue in the baronial revolt against Henry III. He gave out rewards to all of his numerous in-laws, his very unpopular Poitevin half-brothers. That was a problem. It was the central issue in the conflicts of Edward II's reign. There was huge opposition to the king's favorites, first Piers Gaveston and then the two Despensers, mostly because they had a virtual monopoly on royal patronage. They were choking off the stream of royal gifts that made the whole system function. And the barons were willing to take up arms to make sure that the flow of patronage return to normal. And of course, one of the best ways to guarantee that there's extra patronage to go around is to be successful in war. It helps a king a lot if he has expanded the territory under English control, or at least if he's successfully held on to what he has. Think of Edward I and his conquest of Wales. Think of Edward III and Henry V and their triumphs in France. They were all very popular kings. By contrast, think of John losing Normandy and how badly that affected his reputation. Think of Edward II losing the Battle of Bannockburn in Scotland. He really never lived that down. Now, one of the factors that definitely led to the Wars of the Roses in England is the perceived mismanagement of the war in France. That is possibly the decisive factor that tips Richard, Duke of York, over into claiming the English throne for himself. So English kings are definitely expected to win. But English kings also had to win other kinds of battles. They had to learn to be adept at the art of compromise. And this often meant being willing to take good advice. And we've seen that this was a huge issue in many of the controversies between the kings and their barons, because the barons see themselves as the king's natural counselors. Good kings surround themselves with sensible advisors. Bad kings listen to fools. And we've seen this. We've seen Henry III's very silly scheme to conquer Sicily. And you contrast that, say, with his son, Edward I. Edward I needs taxes from his barons, and he gives them a quid pro quo. I'll banish the Jews for you and cancel your debts if you give me taxes. Now, this is not a compromise we would admire today, but under political circumstances in the late 13th century, it was perceived as a win-win situation. Now, so far, I've mainly talked about the kings and their barons, but one of the striking things that you see in English history, and we've touched on this, is how the number of people that the king has to compromise with, that expands over time. The number of people who are actors on the political stage gets greater. And slowly it becomes an established reality that English kings have to consult their subjects about certain important aspects of government, especially taxes. And this movement starts at the time of Magna Carta in 1215. At that point, the people who want their voices heard are mainly the important magnates, the very top of English society. But that will broaden out during subsequent disputes, and it will get focused in the institution of Parliament. And we see a huge step forward in this development during the reign of Henry III. You have the rebel Simon de Montfort establishing the model for all future parliaments. There are going to be representatives from the entire country, and they won't be only the barons. There will be knights from the shires. There will be representatives from the towns as well. So already the number of people whose voices need to be heard is growing. Now, these are property people, certainly, but they extend way beyond the small circle of barons who would have known the king personally. We're really starting to get a concept of abstract representation here. Then, during the 14th century, Parliament takes its final shape as two houses, the Lords and the Commons. And the Commons gain the right to approve or reject taxation. And this comes about in the context of an expensive foreign war, the Hundred Years' War. And that's how the Commons got so much leverage, and they used it to influence royal policy. So this was a very important development on the way to the English people, at least a segment of them, having a say in the way their government was run. But we shouldn't be too sunny in our interpretation of the rise of Parliament. It was still open to manipulation by factions of the barons. Parliament had gained a lot of legitimacy in the nation. It was seen as the repository of the national will to a certain extent, and that made Parliament's approval worth having. But often that approval was extorted under very questionable conditions. For example, we've seen Parliament used to legitimate judicial murder. And this is a trend that really takes off during the reign of Richard II in the 1380s and 1390s, when you see power seesawing back and forth between the king and his political opponents. And there were many instances of this to follow, especially during the Wars of the Roses. But the most dramatic manipulations of Parliament came when Parliament was used to ratify the deposition of kings. This happened first with Edward II, then with Richard II, and then there's a flood of depositions during the Wars of the Roses. You have Henry VI, you have Edward IV, you have Henry VI again. And finally, the most egregious case of all, the deposition of young Edward V by his uncle, Richard III. And we've seen that that probably pushed things a bit too far. People were not totally comfortable with that deposition. Mostly, the English wanted to get rid of kings when they had demonstrated that they were incompetent. Getting rid of an innocent child, that didn't feel quite so legitimate. But here we need to repeat a point about Parliament that I've made a number of times already, simply because we need to explain why the kings got themselves into a position where they had to be on Parliament's good side so that they could get taxes and avoid being deposed. And that point is that Parliament would never have become so powerful if the English kings hadn't needed money, especially to finance foreign wars. If the kings had been able to live off their own resources, they would have been quite happy not to ask Parliament for anything. It wasn't something kings liked, having to summon Parliament. They were likely to hear a lot of complaining, for one thing. But they did it because they needed money. So it's a fundamental fact about English history that the rise of Parliament, the rise really of political rights in England, might never have taken place if the English kings had been richer. Now, it might occur to you that one of the reasons the kings needed money to fight foreign wars is that fighting foreign wars successfully is a good way to be a popular king. So there's an ironic aspect to this relationship between the king and the Parliament. It's kind of circular. The king needs the Parliament to help him pay for the activity that helps him keep popular so that the Parliament will keep voting him taxes. And this drove the kings crazy. As we've seen, they hated being beholden to Parliament. They especially hated it when Parliament spoke its mind about royal administration, about appointments of household officials, expenditures of the royal household, that sort of thing. But the kings really couldn't do without Parliament. So one of the big reasons that Parliament developed as it did, and of course it becomes the model for representative democracies around the world, one of the reasons is that the English kings aren't rich enough to do without it. So Parliament develops as a kind of a foil to the king, a permanently semi-antagonistic dancing partner. And they're destined to clash rather spectacularly, of course, in the 17th century, when Parliament executes King Charles I. But the fact that you've got this dynamic in place, this standing dialogue between king and Parliament, this is actually a sign, in fact, of how stable the English polity really is. And that's a point that I think we really need to make as we conclude our course. We've spent a lot of time on disputes between the king and his barons, between the king and the Parliament. But fundamentally, England is a remarkably stable entity, I think uniquely so in medieval Europe. We saw way back at the beginning of the course how the Wessex monarchy unites the various separate Anglo-Saxon kingdoms into a single, well-governed state. And this actually, ironically, makes England easier to conquer in the 11th century, first for the Danes and then for the Normans. If you can capture the center, the rest of England is going to fall into line also. So maybe that's a weakness if you're facing foreign invasion, but the rest of the time it's really a strength. Because that's how it is for the rest of the Middle Ages. There's just this remarkable degree of unity in the English kingdom. Now, of course, there are many regional differences in terrain, in the economy, even in dialect. We've also seen that Northern England always needed a little bit of special handling. But overall, the commonalities are much more striking than the differences. This Kingdom of England is conceived of as a single unit. Now, there are some fuzzy areas on the borders. The marches with Scotland and Wales shift their location a little bit depending on power struggles. But by and large, England itself is a single unit. Now, there had been one brief proposal to break it up at the time of a revolt during Henry IV's reign, but it never got anywhere. Now, even England's long history of involvement with France doesn't really do anything to shake this fundamental sense that England is its own entity. Now, in part, this is due to the fact that England came with a royal title. So the Norman kings naturally want to play up their identity as kings of England even more than as dukes of Normandy. But the French lands of the English kings never really seriously threatened the